Radio Boston, I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. Two high-profile defections of campaign advisors to gubernatorial candidate Tim Cahill call into question the viability of Cahill's independent run for governor. Meanwhile, the Republican Governors Association launches a new ad attacking the Democratic incumbent.
We had high hopes for Deval Patrick, but he hasn't delivered. Taxes needed to be lowered. Patrick raised them. Jobs needed to be created, but unemployment highest in decades.
In today's weekly news roundup, we'll talk about the latest in the governor's race, Scott Brown's reaction to Harvard's continuing ban on ROTC programs, Mayor Menino advocating torture, and putting that gaping hole in the middle of downtown crossing back on the market. Our Week in Review panelists this week are Joan Vinaki, a columnist for the Boston Globe. Thanks for joining us, Joan.
Nice to be here.
And Ken Cooper, a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who specializes in covering government, politics, and social policy. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Ken.
Good to be here, Sasha.
And listeners, we're taking call during this. We want to know if you're defecting from the Cahill campaign now that you've seen some advisors jump ship, and if so, where you're heading. We want to know if you think Scott Brown has a point in opposing Harvard's ban on the ROTC policy. And we wonder if Menino's comments about torture were out of line in your view, or maybe they were refreshing to you. Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joan and Ken, let's start with those high-profile defections from the Cahill campaign. We know, of course, that Cahill is already pretty far down in the polls behind Deval Patrick and Republican Charlie Baker. Suddenly, overnight, one of his key campaign operatives quits the campaign. This was a former advisor to John McCain. Then this morning, we hear that his chief of staff, Adam Meldrum, who also worked on the McCain campaign, announced he's leaving the Cahill campaign, too. Ken Cooper, what does this mean for Cahill? Is it all over?
Well, I think it's a little too soon to write him off completely. I suspect what has happened here is that both those individuals with the Cahill campaign got considerable pressure from within the Republican Party to abandon his campaign. The Republicans have a big push on to win governor's races, and I'm pretty sure that's probably what happened behind the scenes. I think the question for Cahill is he find the kind of talent he needs to replace those people in his campaign. Certainly there are others who can do the same work, perhaps not as well. It wasn't like those two Republicans were doing such a great job with his campaign already. So,
and Joan Vinaki, Ken Cooper just referenced, that there was pressure from the Republicans to tell these advisors to go elsewhere, and John Weaver is the former McCain advisor who resigned yesterday, and he said pretty bluntly, he said, "It's clear to me that the choice is between Charlie Baker and Governor Patrick. I would prefer Tim Cahill to be the next governor. That's not going to happen." So, Joan, what's your take on this?
Well, I guess I pretty much agree with Ken. To the degree that it's not good news whenever there are headlines about people leaving your campaign. That's what happens when you kind of sign on with cold, soulless, hired guns like these guys. You know, on the other hand, you know, it is a bit of inside baseball. And to the outside world, to the voters, does it matter if John Weaver is calling the shots on the Cahill campaign or not? I don't think so. I agree with Ken. You know, the question is, are other people coming in? Can he sustain a strategy that keeps him somewhat viable in the 5 weeks ahead?
So Cahill may just need another cold, soulless hired gun, and that might fix everything up?
Well, maybe he needs someone who has a more personal commitment to him than these guys did.
Great. Let's talk a bit about these new ads out from the Republican Governors Association, the one we heard at the top of this segment. That one was just part of an ad attacking Deval Patrick. But that isn't the first time, is it, that this group has weighed in on this race? Ken Cooper?
Yes, this is a Republican Governors Association. They also had a considerable ad buy earlier in the year that targeted Tim Cahill and was responsible for, it appears, lowering his numbers substantially. I think that ad that we heard is pretty effective in that it carries a sharp message, but the tone is sort of modulated and soft, so there may not be backlash from that. One of the other ads I saw that basically seemed to be premised on appealing to anti-union sentiment, I don't think it's going to be nearly as effective.
Joan Vinaki, your take on the ad?
I think this ad is really interesting because unlike the bombing that Tim Cahill took from this group, the tone is different. And, you know, talking about hope, that was the Deval Patrick theme in 2006. And it kind of plays to the idea that people are disappointed more than, you know, trying to, stir up anger. And I think it is effective for that reason.
Let's talk also about the Harvard versus Scott Brown situation that came up this week. And the background of this, of course, is that ever since 1969, amid protests about the Vietnam War, Harvard has not allowed the ROTC program on its campus. Scott Brown was part of the effort to not to try to repeal, let me restate this, Scott Brown has said that he might vote to repeal. Forgive me. Part of Scott Brown has weighed in on this and said that for Harvard to continue to expel ROTC for campus at the same time that Harvard is allowing illegal immigrants to attend college, he thinks Harvard has its priorities upside down. And I'm wondering, Ken, if you think is that fair? Is that a fair point Scott makes?
Well, I think the good senator's logic is impaired. He's comparing individuals, undocumented students, with an institution, ROTC. ROTC students are allowed on the campus of Harvard University, and it's a situation the senator should understand well, given that he was enrolled at Tufts University and went to ROTC at Northeastern University, another school.
And Joan?
Well, I think this one's a win-win for Scott Brown, and I have to say I agree with him a bit on this one, you know, despite what Ken said. Harvard has been tying this whole ROTC thing to the principle of don't ask, don't tell, and saying until that's changed, they're not going to change their policy on ROTC. I suppose there is some, you know, principle there worth fighting for. There is a principle there worth fighting for. I'm not sure it resonates with most of the public. They just see this as an elitist university sort of, splitting hairs and making decisions like this. And to tie it into the DREAM Act, I think, is pretty smart on Senator Brown's part because, most people are going to say there should be military recruitment allowed, and that is an upside-down priority up against the rights of illegal immigrants.
We actually have that tape of Scott Brown speaking about this issue. Let's hear that piece of tape.
Why should students who are trying to serve their country be put at a disadvantage? Why should they have to go to another university to join the ROTC program? It's completely upside down.
We have a caller from South Boston who wants to comment on this, and this is Julie. Hi, Julie. What do you think about this?
To be perfectly honest, I just don't really understand why this is a point of issue in the first place. It's a private academic institution, and if they choose to not have ROTC on their campus, that's their personal decision. And I don't think that Scott Brown weighing in or not weighing in makes a bit of difference as to what they ultimately decide.
Ken and Joan, does that seem like a fair point
agree.
To you?
I don't think Scott Brown is going to sway Harvard, but I think he's probably going to score some political points with the constituencies that he cares about.
It may be good politics, but I still maintain it's bad logic. And the second the caller's point, it's not the case that every university has an ROTC program in this country.
Mm-hmm. Scott Brown has also said that he might vote to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, which, of course, was in the news this week. But he said that he wants to wait for the military review of the policy to be completed. Now, it's unlikely that review will be done before the November elections, and we're not sure the Democrats are going to hold on to Congress. So does a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell hold any chance now that it didn't happen this week?
I think it's very uncertain, probably less of a chance if it goes, in fact, into a lame duck session of Congress after the election. I think they probably wouldn't vote on it then. And if there's a Republican Congress, I think the chances of passage go down exponentially.
I agree, but I think that at that point, he probably, if it ever were to come up, he'd vote yes, because then he'd be thinking about his own reelection prospects here in Massachusetts. Again, pure political calculation.
Let's talk about Filene's Basement. This is very fresh news, and this, of course, is the big hole in the ground in the middle of Downtown Crossing, the former Filene's and Filene's Basement building. The developers, Vornado Realty Trust from New York, say we can't get financing, so we can't do it. Now, John Palmieri, who's the director of the Boston Redevelopment Authority, says he's hopeful that a buyer for the project can be found.
You know, in the final analysis, someone will have to come forward, acquire Vornado's interest, and then demonstrate to our satisfaction that they have a development plan that we can approve and the financing required to execute the program.
Now, that's a reference to Vornado, the developer, having said they're going to put the property up for sale. And the reason they're doing this, it looks like, is that the city was just about to revoke its building permits because of this delay. So, Joan Vanacki, is this an example of the city being left high and dry by Vornado, or is this about the best thing that could have happened in this situation? Because, as I understand it, buyers are already lining up to buy.
Well, I'd start off by saying I miss Filene's basement. secondly,
those good deals.
I think it's a good thing. I think they need a new person to come in, and I think the city should just move forward and pull the permits or whatever the, you know, the process thing is at stake right now, and just start over with somebody that, that has the will and the financing to get this done. You know, kind of, enough is enough. Enough promises, enough putting it off. Just go with a new team.
Ken Cooper, city officials have said they can't even remember another time when they pulled permits on a privately owned development site. But John Palmieri of the BRA, who we heard from earlier, says, in his words, it's abundantly clear to us that the developers are ill-equipped to execute the project as it was approved, and the blight that exists there is unprecedented. But do we think that another developer can get the financing that Vornado couldn't?
Well, I think this is a market situation. The current developer was hoping to build condominiums and offices. And apparently the mark of that is very slim, and that's why he had difficulty attracting finances. There have been suggestions that a new development might include apartments, I guess many in rental apartments, and retail space for which there is greater demand in the market right now.
Let's also talk about Mayor Menino, who was in the news this week because he was at a gathering at Emerson College, and the issue came up of this terrible tragedy that happened in Boston recently, where a pizza delivery man was killed by what appears to be three teenagers. Now, of course, this is allegedly. But Menino made a comment that some people were surprised by. We have a copy of that, and I want to say the tape is not of the highest quality. But Menino starts by saying that he'd like to meet the accused teens in a dark alley and have a fight with them. And then he went on to say he'd do some things to them that would be worse than the death penalty.
I do some things to them that would be worse than the death penalty. Because it wouldn't be happening in a second. I'd make them slowly, I would slowly torture them.
Let me repeat that in case the tape was too poor to hear. He said, I'd do some things that would be worse than the death penalty. Because it wouldn't happen in a second, I would slowly torture them. Joan Vanocki, should we be indignant? Or is this really actually why many people like Menino? Because he says out loud what many people might actually be thinking.
Well, the first thing I would say is that those are the perils of talking to, you know, college kids at a communication school.
I think a student recorded it.
He was at Emerson College, probably filled with journalism students who figured, you know, rightly that they could, you know, get a headline out of it if he said something interesting, which he did. I don't know. I'm not, you know, terribly, outraged by what he said. It's kind of Menino being Menino. We don't think of him as a violent person, and he isn't a violent person, but he has seen a lot, you know, in terms of violence in the city. And this particular case, he had a real personal connection to. I think one of the daughters of the man who was killed worked in the mayor's office.
That's right.
And I think he, you know, he felt it in maybe in an even more personal way than he would other incidents. And he was being honest at the moment. He was sort of speaking metaphorically. I don't think it's a terrible thing.
We have a caller calling from Dedham who wants to weigh in on this. This is Gary. Hi, Gary. Gary, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
What are your thoughts about this Menino situation?
Yeah, I certainly support what he said. I don't specifically believe in an eye for an eye, but... Hello?
We're here. We still hear you.
Given the nature of what happened, I totally 100% support what he said.
So
I
think your connection is very poor, but I think we get the general sense of what you're saying. And Ken Cooper, he's saying, you know, he understands where he's coming from. And Menino's spokeswoman, Dot Joyce, has said that Menino is very frustrated by young people that seem to have disregard for life, which is how he views this.
Yeah, I think the mayor has been pretty prominent in displaying empathy to victims of crime in this city. And I think it's one of his more human and effective traits. I actually don't have much problem with this. I take it as kind of a knee-jerk response. I had more of a problem actually with his first response to this killing, where he called the suspects animals. Mm. And in our national discourse, I think if you take a look at it, criminal suspects who get called animals are usually of a particular hue, and only one hue only. They're usually black. So I had more of a problem with him dehumanizing these kids who were obviously disturbed, seriously so, but that doesn't make them non-human.
Mayor Menino has since apologized, and so we might this case might be over. However, some of the defense attorneys for these accused killers are saying that he has basically tainted the jury pool, and so it looks like this actually could have legal ramifications. Do you think, Joan, that we're at risk here of seeing the legal case bollocked up because of this comment?
Well, it sounds like, you know, the defense lawyers are going to do their best to make that happen, and maybe that shows what a weak case they have. I don't know. But I think Ken made a really good point. I mean, the use of the word animals is offensive, and, you know, we also shouldn't forget that, you know, you're innocent until proven guilty.
Before you both go, it's time for our Friday hubbub. This is that one story or idea from the week that you think is worthy of note. And Ken Cooper, let's start with you. What stands out to you?
Well, there was a federally funded study out this week that indicates teacher bonuses tied to student achievement do not increase student achievement. A couple days later, Boston schools and Springfield schools actually received federal grants to do exactly that on a school-wide basis. I think this shows the risk of adopting educational policy that's not founded on solid research.
Mm. And Joan Vanacki, your Friday hubbub?
Well, I'm just going to go back to the governor's race and just make reference to one line from the debate the other night that I thought was really interesting. When Deval Patrick said, "I don't see government as a math problem. I see the faces behind the line items." And I think that theme of faces versus numbers is kind of a good way of describing the two philosophies that we're going to see doing battle over the next few weeks. And I'm not sure, you know, which side will win, but I just think it bears watching, as they say.
The idea that there's real people behind the economic pain.
Real people, whether or not government, sort of the role and definition of government, is it there to help people who need government, or, you know, on the other side, is it just about numbers adding up a certain way?
Yeah. Well, mine is lighter than both of yours, and this is related to a parking ticket that one of the producers on Radio Boston happened to get this week in Cambridge. And it wasn't your typical parking ticket, because on it are little instructions on how to do yoga positions. In fact, one of them shows two figures, and it says, "Breathe out, reach back to give and receive the citation," meaning the parking citation. Well, it turns out that the city of Cambridge has printed 40,000 of these tickets as part of a public art project by the city's artist in residence. And the city says that the purpose of these tickets is to debunk the idea that all parking tickets are a hostile action. So that in itself is funny, but the comments on the website where the story has been or even funnier, people saying Cambridge living up to its stereotype. One person wrote, "I wonder if the tickets were printed on fair trade paper recycled in the third world countries using organic ink." So it's Cambridge being Cambridge. Joan Vanacki and Ken Cooper, thanks to both of you for coming on. Ken Cooper is an independent journalist who's reported for the Boston Globe and Washington Post, among other papers. And Joan Vanacki is a columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Coming up after the break, we'll talk about the lessons learned from WBUR's week-long series on the economic challenges facing communities across the state. I'm Sasha Pfeiffer. This is Radio Boston.